Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Pod Save the People. Now, when I think about power, I think about power being a combination of participation plus impact. And that when we think about equity versus equality, we know that equality is when everybody gets the same thing, and equity is when people get what they deserve. And when we talk about the work of social justice, it is often work of equity. It is about making sure people get what they deserve given the circumstances, given a history, and given disparity in outcomes. And the power equation is interesting because sometimes it's attacked at the participation level, that there are things like voter ID laws that are trying to change the way that people can participate by making sure that fewer people can participate than otherwise. And there's some things that are about the impact. So no matter how many meetings you go to, your voice doesn't matter in some places. No matter how many times you call, no matter how many times you do X, Y, and Z, that the impact of your participation is null. But we know what it means to restore power is that when people participate, it means something, and that they have a chance to participate. So today, after me, Brittany, and Sam go through the news, we'll talk to a panel of experts about voter ID. Because this conversation about voting and voter ID laws is actually more nuanced than I think often hits the public conversation. So I'm hoping that this is a space where we can talk about it more in depth. In the end, we have to know the world as it is to make it as we want it to be. And it's why we always talk about get educated, get organized, take action. And now me, Brittany Packnett, and Samuel Sinyagwe talk about the news of the week.
It's the news.
With DeRay and
Brittany.
Sam Sinyagwe.
It's us. It's me, Sam, and Brittany back together to talk about the news. So here we go. The three of us are in three different parts of the country today as we, you know, do the work. Sam, let's start with you. Oh, Sam, it was Sam's birthday, everybody. Sam, for the last two times we've been together, there have been huge moments in his life. So it was his 2000th year anniversary of being in a relationship, which we are proud of you. Again, the longest thing I've ever done is go to college. And Sam also turned 21, which is incredible.
I mean, it's kind of not true, right? Because if it was his 2000th year anniversary, then
he's like
2027. But yeah.
Sam is 27,
happy
everybody.
Happy birthday, Sam.
And
thank you.
Happy birthday. What did you do for your birthday?
Not much. You know, just explore the city, eat at a nice place. I had some good Caribbean food, which was delicious.
Sam, you sound like somebody's uncle. You're like, eat at a nice place. Like, okay.
They had tablecloths.
Right. Like, I had soda. It's like, okay. Okay, well.
That's dope, Sam. We go ahead, you had a good day.
Right. For people that don't know, Sam used to live on the West Coast and recently, a year ago-ish, moved to New York City. So every day in New York City is like an adventure for Sam, and that is awesome. If you ever meet Sam, take him to a nice place to eat that has tablecloths and soda.
Okay. Every day is like your birthday in New York City, Sam.
Right.
Just because of that.
Sam, what's your... You start us off.
So, first piece of news, Jeff Sessions. So, Jeff Sessions this past week rescinded the rules change or the memo that Eric Holder, as Attorney General, made. Basically, what this means is that prosecutors are now directed to seek the maximum sentences, even for low-level drug violations. So Sessions basically threw gasoline on the war on drugs, reversed all the progress that has been made under the Obama administration, and will undoubtedly increase incarceration rates, particularly for black folks.
This is making America great again, right?
It's so crazy.
Right. Is that what we're doing?
Sam, what were you going to say?
I mean, basically, he did what they've been saying on the campaign trail for the past year and a half, and what everybody was sort of expecting. I mean, it was written in their platform that they were going to be, you know, quote unquote, tough on crime, and they're sort of delivering on that terrible vision right now.
And the thing is that violent crime actually isn't on the rise. You know?
Yeah.
And that is frustrating that he's like peddling the slide. And also mandatory minimums, like they were an experiment in the criminal justice system that was only bad for black and brown people.
Yeah.
And he's like reinforcing them.
I mean, tough on crime, we know, after all these years, as you said, has wreaked havoc on black and brown communities. And to me, that seems expressly why they are doing it, right? I know we talked a little bit about conspiracy last week, and that we actually have to be really thoughtful about being honest about what's happening. So to me, if violent crime isn't going up, you take an action or you make a move like this in order to regain the kind of order and control that you once had during a tough on crime era, not in spite of all of the evidence that it destroys black and brown communities, but perhaps because of all of the evidence that it destroys black and brown communities.
And the thing that people aren't talking about that is actually one of the insidious things about this is not only, or better yet, is that we know that the charging people with the most intense version of what you can charge them with actually encourages people to plea out because they're like, I don't want that really bad thing. And that we anticipate this to shift to even more plea bargains than currently exist. And we know that people in under-resourced communities often plea out to things that they should have a trial for. That, like, you know, everybody's talked about for a long time that if everybody asked for a trial, it would cripple the criminal justice system. And this is just going to encourage more plea bargains for people who otherwise wouldn't have to incur a harsh penalty.
Right. And so we, under Obama, the last couple of years of his presidency, incarceration rates actually were starting to decline, especially for black folks. And then, you know, this obviously is going to push them right back up. So,
yeah,
for no reason whatsoever.
You're about to say for no reason.
Yeah. I mean, well, all this time, this is what we had to lose, right? That's what we got asked as black folks during the campaign. And it was this. It is exactly as bad as it sounds.
And what about Rand Paul? Didn't Rand Paul come out with some statement being like, Jeff Sessions is not good?
Right. Yeah, Rand Paul makes he wrote a great op-ed where he's talking about how this is the wrong decision and it's going to result in higher incarceration, particularly for black folks. But then, you know, he voted to confirm Jeff Sessions. And so, this is the classic Republican, you know, we're going to say I might disagree with Trump or I'm troubled by Trump's remarks or Sessions. And then every single time they actually have an opportunity to use their power to block Trump or Sessions, you know, they do that. So hollow words.
I mean, this is why accountability for elected officials is so important, right? It is not going to be enough to have simply lodged your complaint in the form of an op-ed if you didn't take the right action when you had the chance to actually leverage your power as an elected official, right? And this to me is exactly what playing politics is. Politics is, I will say one thing and do another. And I think the people all across the country are saying enough is enough. We're just not going to stand for that anymore.
Yeah, and Rand Paul, you know, has tried to be the, like, middle of the road, I believe in criminal justice sort of, criminal justice reform sort of. I think about the stuff around the civil asset forfeiture, which we should talk about at another time, but this is disappointing. And like you said, Brittany, it's like the integrity question, right? Like, how does what you say match up to what you do? And this is the classic critique of Washington, that they don't match up often. And again, this well-worded op-ed is not going to save anybody's life.
It really is not. And at the end of the day, Rand Paul isn't the one who's going to suffer from these choices.
That's a word right there, Brittany. He is absolutely not going to suffer.
I'm just right. Like, there might be some political fallout because you wrote this op-ed, but you're still going to be a senator. You are still going to have all of the rights and privileges bestowed upon you because you are not a convicted felon. You have not been incarcerated. You will not be incarcerated. So it is simply not enough to say one thing and do another, especially when you have the privilege of not suffering from the choices that you've made.
Sam, what's your second piece of news?
So my second piece of news is this global hack that occurred a couple days ago where basically computers all across the world were hacked with something called ransomware, where the person had to give money to the hacker in order to be able to access all the files on their computer. And this coincides with a hack today of ISIS's Twitter account, which replaced their photos with the rainbow flag. And to juxtapose those, because on the one hand you have hackers causing harm and trying to take people's money, and on the other hand you have them targeting terrorists.
I didn't know ISIS's Twitter account got hacked. I missed that.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, so I wanted to put that out here, just have a conversation about the ethics of hacking and where hackers decide to focus their efforts.
This is timely after the conversation with Mr. Snowden last week. You know, what's interesting about the hack in the UK that you're talking about is that it was of the hospital system. It was of a host of systems, but one was a hospital. And it is a reminder of the increasing threat in the digital age of privacy. What does privacy mean in the digital age in a functional way? And we talk a lot about what it means at the most, the hyperlocal, right? So from body cameras and surveillance in some places to predictive policing. But then you think about what it looks like at the macro when doctors can't log into people's health records, you know?
Yeah, and this question of ethics always requires a conversation about accountability. And I don't know much about this territory, but from a layperson's perspective, it kind of seems like the Wild West in that there aren't a lot of rules, right? There is not accountability. And so who's to say if you use your hacking abilities for good or for evil, what could happen to you, what repercussions there could be? Obviously, that's the point, but it's hard to discuss ethics or something if there's actually no measure to hold people accountable to a certain standard.
Yeah, we should, and Sam, that makes me think, we should have a whole separate, we should do a separate conversation about sort of cybersecurity in blackness, right? Or cybersecurity in 2017, what that looks like. And the Snowden conversation, I think, is an entrance way to it, but that was not a full conversation. It was a conversation between he and I, so we should do that.
That'd be dope. And diversity within the industry as well, right? So how does the race of the hacker impact, who they decide to focus their energy on?
I will say one of the things I asked Snowden was I'm shocked that Trump's tax returns aren't out. Just because people have leaked everything else. And it's did he even file taxes? That actually wouldn't surprise me, that he just didn't even file them, which is the only reason they're not leaked.
Right. And especially you see these hackers, they're hacking the entire world, all these institutions, but nobody can find Trump's tax returns.
Not that we're advocating hacking his tax returns. Please, FBI, don't visit the house. You've already come enough. And I guess all of us got visited.
You've already made it to Target from that bonus pod,
Yeah, don't.
We've already been a target. Let's be clear.
That's true. We've been.
I'm just saying.
Your house.
I'm shocked. Brittany, did they visit your house?
Not that I know of, but there were some strange happenings in my old office. So
some strange happenings. Brittany, you sound like somebody. You sound auntie. Auntie Brittany, there were some strange happenings in
this
my
sounds
office.
Like they just showed up at your office like the Matrix.
Right. There's some strange.
Well, but I travel a lot, right? So it's people don't exactly know what conversations were about. But yeah, strange happenings indeed. But suffice it to say that when you are a person of color, privacy concerns are different. When you are an outspoken person of color, privacy concerns are even more acute.
I have more news. Beyonce is nominated for 7 BET Awards. That's the good news today.
Come on, B. This is why institutions for people of color, run by people of color, matter, right? Because for a lot, as soon as I saw that headline, I will say that I was like, oh, okay, great. BET is going to correct the mistake of the Grammys. Now, before everybody tweets at me, I love Adele. I think Adele is incredible. I also know that Lemonade has a Peabody. Lemonade was one of the greatest albums of all time for a whole lot of reasons, not just vocally, but visually, artistically, lyrically. It was really incredible. It was seminal and transformative for a lot of women of color, black women in particular. And I think it might have just like been like too black for some people. But yeah, when I first saw it, I was like, oh, great. BET's gonna correct the record.
And Solange has 4 nominations.
Sure Lemonade gets what it deserves.
Solange Good. And Chance the Rapper also have 4 nominations. So that'll be the one bright spot in the rest of the news that we have. But I will turn over to Brittany.
I wish I had news that good. I was very happy when I saw the headlines about the BET Awards today. I was not very happy when I was walking through the airport yesterday, which, by the way, you all, is back where I am. So if there's a lot of background noise, I apologize. We're all moving around the country trying to do this work. I'm about to get ready for a cross-country flight. But I was in the store in the airport looking at magazines, as I always do. And the cover of Time magazine this week says, warning, we are not ready for the next pandemic. I am not someone who usually falls for kind of the very scary headlines. But this one in particular worried me, especially as we've moved away from more universal forms of healthcare as Trump care passed the House, as we're recognizing more and more how few choices have really been made in the Trump administration by way of appointments and these kinds of things. I was like, let me pick this up and read it. And what I read made me very scared. So there is a new strain of the bird flu called H7N9. That was found in chickens in China, but it has officially started to move from chickens to humans. And of course, if you understand diseases, which a lot of you probably do more than I do, it will eventually move from humans to humans. Given that the world's population is higher than it was in the day of our last flu pandemic in 1918, given the fact that people move around more often because millions of people are taking flights every single day, there is a very good chance that should this and when this comes to our shores, we will not be prepared to handle it. And that is not just kind of because of infrastructural reasons. It is absolutely because of policy reasons. There currently is no director of the CDC. We know that, you know, junior members, more junior members of agencies and departments all across the administration have been leaving because they don't want to work for this administration. So there are roles unfilled at every single level. And then we have indications about where this particular president's priorities are, because had the budget that he proposed passed, he was proposing a slashing of critical funding to the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, to National Institutes of Health, and importantly to the State Department's foreign aid budget. And that is the work, that's the money that's used, rather, to help fight diseases all across the world. He was set to cut that budget by 28%. So these ideas of nationalism fall so short when we fail to think about all of the ways in which we engage in a global society, not just economically, but when it comes to our health.
You know, Brittany, I've thought more and more about how people talk about this notion that all politics is local. And I think that that sounds right. I think that one of the things that we are seeing in the wake of the Trump administration is that the federal government actually has a huge impact on your life, you know?
Huge.
And you know, because we talked about it, is that you know that there are people who are like, I'm not going to vote for the president because the president doesn't deal with my life. And it's like, you get this random disease or virus that actually could have been avoided if the federal government actually had a barrier to make sure that there was some sort of medical protection or adherence to something. And it's just not there, you know?
No, that's absolutely right. And what's more is that climate change helps perpetuate a quicker spreading of disease. So with warmer climates, the kinds of insects that help carry diseases, people engage with them more frequently, right? That's what happened with Zika. And so not only is the planet itself getting warmer, but we have a president who denies the existence of climate change, right, and who hires people in a critical environmental protection role that also deny or don't believe in the existence of climate change. So at every layer, this affects us. But at the end of the day, if you get sick, right, and you can't take care of yourself or you can't take care of your family or, God forbid, you cannot afford the health care that will save your life, you're not thinking about all of the policy decisions. You are just simply wondering why people didn't care enough to make sure that we're protected, not just in America, all across the world. But you're absolutely right. I was doing some campaign work last year, and there were folks who were saying, well, vote for everyone locally, but don't worry about filling out president, because ultimately that doesn't matter in your life. But cabinet appointments, policies, basic philosophies of governing, right? Nationalism, the denial of climate change, we're seeing how all of those things can very easily affect us. And if and when this comes, we will not be prepared for it. So I wish I had like a nice bow to tie that up in. I think, you know, certainly pick up Time Magazine this week if you want to know more about it, because I'm not a medical expert or an expert on disease, but it certainly scared me, but I'm glad I picked it up so that I could educate myself.
So that is the news for this week, and we'll be back next week. Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Don't go anywhere. There's more to come. And joining us today for a special segment on voter rights and voter ID is an incredible panel. One leader from Rock the Vote, another from the Brennan Center, and another from the Lawyers Committee. Here we go. So today we are joined by three experts on voting rights, and this has been a hot topic in the news. It's been an important topic for the past 50 years or so, and I'm happy that we have people here. So we're going to go through, do brief introductions. It's the first panel on Pod Save the People. So these are incredible friends of the pod because we're doing this, and they're three powerhouses. So we'll start with Carolyn. Who are you?
I am Carolyn DeWitt. I'm president and executive director of Rock the Vote. Rock the Vote has been around for 27 years. We basically fuse technology, culture, and art and civic in the civic space to try and get young people involved in our political process. And with that, we always are interested in trying to make the process of registering and voting easier and more accessible for young people and therefore all people.
And Kristen Clark from the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law.
Hi, this is Kristen. I'm president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. And we were founded in 1963 during the heyday of the civil rights movement at the behest of John F. Kennedy, who issued a call to action for lawyers to mobilize to do more to come to the aid of victims of discrimination. We fight voter suppression across the country. We lead the nation's largest nonpartisan voter protection program called Election Protection. And we fight on criminal justice, fair housing, education, and many other issues gripping the nation.
And then Tomas Lopez with the Brennan Center.
Hi, DeRay. I'm Tomas Lopez. I am a voting rights attorney with the Brennan Center for Justice. We're a nonpartisan law and policy institute that's affiliated with NYU Law School, and we try to use a diverse set of tools as lawyers to improve our systems of democracy and justice. We fight in the courts. We fight in our legislatures and in Congress. We try to write reports that can affect public policy, and we also work hard to try to affect public opinion. And so, you know, we're really proud often to get to work with the Lawyers Committee and with Rock the Vote, and it's exciting to be here with all of you.
Well, here we go. Let's jump right into the conversation. Let's level set a little bit around the past. So can we start with the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act? What did the Voting Rights Act do that was necessary, that didn't exist before?
So the Voting Rights Act of 1965 is undeniably our country's most important federal civil rights law. And it was put in place because states across the country were resorting to dirty tricks and tactics to lock African Americans and other minority communities out of the ballot box. Whether you're talking about poll taxes or literacy tests, states were all about excluding minority communities from the ballot box. And when Congress put this law on the books, The goal was to tear down those barriers so that everyone would have access to democracy. And there was some, there's some strong medicine in the Voting Rights Act that helped ensure that outcome. The heart of the Voting Rights Act is known as the Section 5 preclearance provision. And this part of the Voting Rights Act applied to states with really long and egregious histories of voting discrimination, states that just time and time again work to make it hard for Black folks in particular to vote. And what the law said was that before they could put any new law into effect, they had to demonstrate to the federal government or to a court that there was no discriminatory effect or purpose behind the law. And that strong medicine literally helped to block hundreds of discriminatory voting laws from ever going into effect. Dramatic turning point happens in 2013 when the Supreme Court issues a ruling called Shelby County, Alabama v. Holder, which essentially gutted that provision of the law and brought that federal review process to a grinding halt. When the court issued that ruling, it basically turned us back to the 60s. It opened the floodgates to voter suppression laws across the country. Texas's voter ID law, North Carolina's monster voter suppression law. I mean, all of these are laws that would never have gone into effect if we had that strong provision of the Voting Rights Act in place.
Now, Kristen, I thought that there were, and again, you know this better than I do. I remember reading that it wasn't like fully repealed, but something with the formula changed. Can you, like, what is the, what's the what there?
So there's another provision of the Voting Rights Act called the coverage provision. And that's the part of the Voting Rights Act that identified the states with very long and egregious track records of voting discrimination. The Supreme Court's ruling basically found that coverage provision unconstitutional, and it basically kicked the law back to Congress to say, come up with a new coverage provision. But until you do that, the federal review process can't go forward.
Oh,
and
wow.
We know that sadly, because of the politically toxic environment that we've been living in for the last few years, that Congress has failed to restore and renew the Voting Rights Act in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision, which
this
puts us in the place that we are today.
And this is, and Tomas, I know you're about to say something, so either one of you or anybody, this is not a quiz, but I do want to know, what are the places that were included in the law? Like, what are the places that had an egregious history of voting discrimination in the past?
Well, there were a range of state places that were covered. There were a number of states that were covered completely. And as you would imagine, there were places, many of them in the Deep South, that were covered. States like Alabama, states like Texas. But there were other places as well that people wouldn't necessarily guess would be covered by the provisions of the Voting Rights Act. The boroughs of New York City.
Really?
The state of Arizona. That's right. Yes, because of ways the law was revised at times over the years. To include protections for language minorities, and the boroughs of New York City used to be covered by the preclearance provisions of the VRA. Much of North Carolina was covered, although it was most of the counties, not the entire state. There were a few counties in Florida. The total, was not, the entire country. It really was a select group of places that over the course of time had been identified to have to be subjected to this process.
It's a combination, Dre, it's a combination of states, you have counties and you have townships as well. So to get real specific, Brennan Center actually has some good resources that you can look at that breaks it down into exactly where.
We'll make sure that people have access to those. I was just interested. Okay, we can go back. So let me paraphrase back. Coverage Act, the federal government or the Supreme Court ruled that that part was unconstitutional, pushed it back to the courts. Congress has to decide who is now covered. They have to renegotiate the entire clearance process. Is that what Congress needs to do?
Sadly, that's what Congress needs to do.
And Congress until they do it, the old clearance process is no longer used. That is correct.
Correct.
That's right.
Got it.
That's
okay.
Right.
Thank you for that.
Go ahead. What's really striking about this is that in 2006, Congress overwhelmingly passed legislation that renewed the Voting Rights Act, including the preclearance provision and including the preclearance formula that was struck down in 2013.
So it's like Congress did make a decision recently, and they upheld both the spirit, the intent, and the language, is what you're saying.
That's right.
Got it. Yep. Okay.
In fact, Congress renewed Section 5 by a margin of 98-0. There was basic unanimity across the board, tremendous bipartisan support for the fact that voting discrimination was alive and well, and that we still needed the strong medicine of the Voting Rights Act to counteract all of the problems that we were seeing in many parts of the country.
I would actually say, I think one of the things we look at is we don't just need a restoration of the Voting Rights Act back where it was, but we actually need to strengthen it and expand it, because a lot of the restrictive laws we're seeing be passed in these last few years wouldn't have even been covered under Section 5.
Oh, that's in places like where?
Wisconsin, Kansas.
Oh, Wisconsin wasn't covered under the old coverage map provision. Interesting. Right. Okay. So level set, that makes sense. Now, there are a lot of people who would say, and I've heard a lot of people who believe in justice and equity sort of in their heart. They say things like, well, people should have an ID, right? Like, what's the hubbub? Like, you need an ID to do so many things in the world that why shouldn't you have an ID? Why shouldn't you need an ID when you vote? What's the response to that?
In my view, most people in our country have government-issued photo ID. There are people who board planes regularly, and so they've got a passport, they have a car, and they drive. This fight is about people on the margins, the poorest people in our country who function every day because they ride public transportation, because they've never been on a plane. The data shows that about 11% of people across our country do not have ID.
Oh, wow.
For elderly people who may have been born at home to midwives, they don't have a birth certificate or the ability to get an ID. Under some laws that have been put on the books in states like Texas, a conceal and carry permit qualifies as ID, but a student ID does not. We know that these laws are about knocking out certain people from the political process in our country, and it's why we've got to fight back. We want a democracy where every eligible American can vote and have their voice heard. And if there are rules that are knocking off 10, 11% of Americans, that's deeply problematic.
That is a lot of people. Carolyn?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Kristen said it. These are people on the margin. So 11%, to give you some perspective, is over 22 million voters.
Wow.
So students often don't have IDs to reflect their campus address, right? Young people, low-income folks often move. They don't have IDs with their current address. Traveling to get an ID is difficult for voters who have disabilities. Low-income voters, those who make less than $35,000, are two times as likely to lack a government ID as those who bring in more. 25% of Black Americans don't have a current government ID versus 8% of white Americans. And up to 18% of 18 to 24-year-olds don't have photo IDs with their current address. So we're really talking about these certain groups that definitely they're being picked off make it harder for them to vote.
Just like in North Carolina, where the language, when it was overturned, they said that they used surgical precision to make sure that people in marginalized communities. That seems to be what you're talking about. Tomas, why? So what people say is like, this will just increase voter fraud, right? That like not having IDs will mean that there's all these fraudulent votes that happen. Like, is that true? Is that not true? What do we know?
One of the things that we know, DeRay, is that voter fraud, the kind that gets talked about where somebody shows up and says that they're somebody who they're not, or somebody voting twice, or somebody who's not a citizen voting, is really, really rare. We've done some research on this. Others have done research on this. The incident rates kind of fall somewhere between 0.0003% and 0.0025%.
Whoa.
We're talking very low rates of the kind of fraud that, you know, people worry about when they talk about justifying these strict ID requirements.
Now, why is the solution not then to get everybody an ID? Because that's what I've heard, right? So people are like, okay, I get it. Some people don't have IDs, like elderly people, blah, blah, blah. So why shouldn't the push be to give everybody an ID then?
So what I would say is let's wait until the day in which every American citizen has government-issued ID before we put these laws on the books. The reality is that to get a driver's license or a passport today, you've got to navigate a lot of bureaucracy. You've got to be willing to take time off of work to sit at a local agency and wait and pay fees. And for a lot of poor people, that is a burden that they should not have to face to exercise the most sacred right in our democracy. So let's wait. Let's wait until a day in which every American has gotten a government ID in their pocket before we put this kind of obstacle between American citizens and the ballot box.
Carolyn?
Yeah, I would say, so there are two things. One, there are states who have said, okay, we, having voter ID laws opens this up to lawsuits. So what we're gonna say is we're gonna have free voter IDs. Well, the true cost to that actually is somewhere between $75 and $175, and it can actually increase into about $1,500. When adjusted for inflation, the cost of the so-called free ID is actually more expensive than the poll taxes that were required of blacks in the South that were trying to prevent them from voting before the VRA.
So how is a free ID? What is it? Then what's a free ID?
It's like the cost of transportation. It's the cost of time, right? So, you know, there's a story of a gentleman in Wisconsin who had to go to 7 different government agencies to try and get his ID fixed because there was a clerical error when he was born on his birth certificate. So there are just, and you hear stories about that all over. And like Kristen said, you know, to someone who's living paycheck to paycheck or to someone who's elderly on Social Security, $75 is not a small amount of money.
Right.
In addition, when you're talking about to try and implement from the state side, implement voter ID policy, it's studies have shown it's going to cost the state about $20 million per state to implement a full-scale voter ID law.
I'd never heard of this idea of people offering free voter IDs, but doing it in, like, A, I didn't know that I didn't know people were doing that. B, people find a way to make anything really shady, you know? Like, that is...
Hey, talking about shady, Alabama. Alabama closed down DMV offices in 31 of its 67 counties, and most of those office closures were in majority black, poor areas of the rural Black Belt section of the state. That, to me, is the epitome of shadiness. So even when you have states saying, okay, we're going to make it easy for people to get IDs, you see dirty tricks like what unfolded in Alabama, where they shut those places down in the very places where Black people live.
And Tomas, from a policy perspective, what is... Can you help start this conversation about what the solutions are? So when I hear about voter ID, I normally hear it from the, like, the opposite, right? People are like, there shouldn't be rules, or we shouldn't have to have people get IDs. How do we codify it? Like, what's the policy prescription? So if people are like, what can I do? I believe that people should vote. I think these rules are cumbersome. Like, I want to go fight for insert here. Like, what do you say to
right.
them?
Right. Well, I think, you know, we put a couple of things forward. You know, the first thing I would mention is, you know, people talk about there being, you know, the alternative being zero voter ID. And the fact is, under federal law, there's a baseline that even when you register to vote, you have to prove on some level that you are who you say you are, that you've got to submit a driver's license or a social security number or some document that has your name and address on it. It's just not necessarily a photo ID or something as strict as has been set up in Texas. And that typically happens at the point where you're registering to vote. And it's that registering to vote where I think that's where we see the real opportunity. You've got 50 million unregistered voters in the United States, and they're often people who are registered to vote are often registered through a system that is antiquated, it's bloated. There are parts of it that are still on paper in plenty of states. And there are a lot of things that can be done that really shouldn't be all that politically complicated, that can actually build a modern system and get people registering to vote. It's stuff that can sound pretty boring, but if you made it the case that people were automatically registered to vote, as is the case now in a handful of states that have begun to adopt this, that's something where you're taking away one of the surprisingly large barriers to the ballot that exists today.
What are some of the states where there's automatic voter registration?
Sure. So the first state to put it in place was Oregon. It's also the law in California. One of the places that was really interesting.
It's a law in California?
It's a law in California. It hasn't been implemented yet, but they passed it in California.
Okay.
New in California.
When does it start in California?
The law passed, I want to say, last year, maybe even late 2015. You're kind of catching me. It's pretty new. West Virginia is a place actually where they've done this, where again they're doing this and they're beginning to, figure out kind of how to do it. Vermont, Connecticut has implemented this administratively, and so there are places that are looking at this that say this is actually common sense. And the point that advocates like us try to make when we talk about that particular reform is that if you're automatically registering people to vote, it's a win-win, because for the voter, they don't have to worry about going through the process of registering. They also don't have to worry about going through the process, if you have it fully in place, of updating their address. In a lot of states, it's the case that you could move across the street and you'd have to register to vote again, or you could move to another part of the state, another county, and again, you'd have to register to vote. And your voter registration doesn't move with you when you change your address to the post office. You've got to get that taken care of. This is a reform that you're moving within a state that can help take care of that. And then we call it a win-win on the other side for people who run elections, because that's keeping the voter rolls up to date. A lot of the people who talk about wanting these strict laws say that they want to do this because of concerns that people can vote twice, that people could be registered in multiple places. But if this can actually help address some of those concerns, because this is actually keeping the rolls more in line with where people actually are.
And I definitely didn't know that automatic registration was so expansive. Like, to me, I feel like I heard about Oregon because that just happened. There was I feel like that was in the press really big. Does the data suggest that automatic registration leads to more voters voting?
We're just starting to see the data on it. I think Oregon has just started to put some stuff out, and definitely I'll be honest, it's pretty new. I think we still have to kind of go through it. Certainly, the hope is that we're seeing more registrations, and then in turn, then there's more net participation. But I think there's more work to be done to actually kind of assess it and see, okay, what are the kind of broader effects. But what we know is that when people register, it tends to be now that's one less thing they have to worry about to getting to the polls.
Yeah, and that does address the access issue, that like you are now creating access to participate at scale, right? Which is something that doesn't exist otherwise. And what I didn't, it wasn't until I became an adult that I realized that there were registration deadlines, right? That that you have to like decide to vote, I don't know, 60 days or 80 days before the actual election, that like you couldn't just like wake up in the morning, you're like, I'm gonna vote today, which is real in so many places.
Well, that's actually another point to make, is that in addition to automatic voter registration is not the only policy change that we can work toward. There's same day registration, which does exist in some states as well. And then there's, of course, expanding access to voting, like early voting and vote by mail options too.
Doesn't everybody vote by mail? Like, is vote by mail different from absentee?
There are different names for different things, but sometimes you can have no excuse vote by mail. So in some states, you might be required to have to have an excuse of why you can't.
Oh, like
that.
I'm out of state or like I'm traveling or something like that. That's right. Interesting. Okay, got it. What were you going to say, Kristen?
Yeah, I just want to echo that same-day registration is a really powerful tool for expanding access. Minnesota historically has had exceptionally high voter turnout rates, and it's because of same-day registration. It's because people have the opportunity to establish their eligibility and vote on election day. But one important reform that we can't leave out of this discussion is the need to restore voting rights for people with criminal histories. There are so many states that continue to this day to disenfranchise people with convictions on their records, and it's a huge racial injustice. There are about one out of every 13 African Americans in our country who have lost their voting rights because of these laws that disenfranchise people with convictions on their record. Florida is a particularly bad state. About 25% of African Americans are disenfranchised there because of their law. And in 2018, voters will have the opportunity to vote on a ballot initiative that could cure this problem. But a really important issue for those who care about taking laws off the books that have been there for decades that were very much racially motivated when lawmakers put them in place. And, you know, these are laws that have tremendous racial impact today.
And what do you say? Another thing that I've heard, so I'd love to know your, like, the experts, is that I know a lot of people who are like, I'm not going to register to vote because I'm going to have to sign up for jury duty. Do you hear that? Like, I definitely have heard that. So I'd love to know what you would somebody has to say to those people.
I will say that I don't have a great sort of scientific response to this. I do know that anecdotally, I say this, you know, as a voting rights lawyer, my own mom has been resistant to register to vote at times, and one of the things that got her to finally do that, and she lives in Florida now. Sorry, mom, was that she got called for jury duty anyway.
Well, there we go.
And so, you know, and I wanted to circle back because people talk about you mentioned there people not thinking that, you know, trying to avoid voting in some ways. And it really kind of puts into relief what Kristen was talking about the need to restore voting rights for people with past criminal convictions. Because when you put the raw numbers on, it's even more striking. It's a total of 6 million Americans who can't vote because of a criminal conviction. 4.7 million people out of that group are people who are not even currently in prison.
Have we ever had an election day on the weekends, or like, is it always on during the week?
Election day is set by statute for Tuesday, the Tuesday after the first Monday of the month. And that's been the case for quite some time. I think it's an important question looking to see whether moving elections to the weekend, consolidating the election calendar so there aren't dozens of local, state, and federal elections that you have to turn out for. I think it's important that we think about whether those kinds of reforms can help improve turnout and participation. When we look at other countries, we know that there are countries in Europe, for example, that hold elections on the weekend, and they see significantly higher turnout rates than we've had here in the U.S.
Tomas, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, and that's what makes early voting something really important.
Hmm.
The ability to vote not just on election day, but in the days and weeks ahead of election day. When the Fourth Circuit in that North Carolina case was talking about how that law was designed with almost surgical precision to get at people of color, one of the things they were talking about was the ways in which African-American voters used early voting in North Carolina. And the reason why people talked about that North Carolina law as the way Kristen described it, the monster voter suppression law, was that it wasn't just a voter ID law. It was a law that reduced the availability of early voting. It was a law that got rid of the ability to register to vote on Election Day, and it was also a law that took away the right for people to pre-register to vote. So 16 and 17-year-olds could get a driver's license, fill out the paperwork so that when they turned 18, they'd be able to just go ahead and vote. Thankfully, the Supreme Court, on the day that we're recording, issued a decision where they decided not to hear an appeal of that Fourth Circuit decision, and so that's staying in place, and that's a really important victory.
But didn't Roberts come out with didn't he release an opinion that was something odd? What did he say?
I think Roberts said, I think specifically referenced the fact that, you know, in declining to hear the case, you know, there was this issue in North Carolina where the state had been pursuing this appeal. In the interim, there was an election, there was a new governor, there was a new attorney general. And so what the Supreme Court said was that, you know, it's sort of indicating in a way that this may have contributed to their thinking on the issue. And it's certainly not the only case at all that is floating out there. But it's still a really significant outcome.
So was his opinion a good thing, a bad thing, a neutral thing?
I think it was a neutral thing. At the end of the day, the Supreme Court declining to hear the Fourth Circuit decision on North Carolina's voter suppression law is a win. It's okay. A win for people who are fighting voter suppression. And it leaves intact this powerful ruling from the Fourth Circuit that found that state lawmakers not only adopted a law that had a discriminatory effect on Black and minority communities in North Carolina, they also found that the law was adopted with a discriminatory purpose. And so that decision stands, and it should be a deterrent to other states around the country that are working to suppress the vote. So I view the Supreme Court's decision not to hear this case to be a huge victory.
Got it. And Carolyn, what about online registration? I know that Rock the Vote, you know, I know Rock the Vote from when I was a teenager, and I saw all the cool like events and stuff that Rock the Vote did. I'm assuming that Rock the Vote does more than just cool events, and I believe that Rock the Vote also does online registration. But can you talk about, like, is online registration in all 50 states? Is it everywhere? Is it not? Like, what's the registration story that's not being told?
What's the story? So online voter registration. So there is some good news happening sort of in voter registration world. So since 2014, 20 states have joined up to make a total of 38 states plus D.C., that have adopted and allowed for online voter registration. What we do at Rock the Vote is we actually have an online voter registration tool that other third parties, so other nonprofits, individuals, whoever wants to, can actually customize it and use it themselves and put it on their website. Or you can come to rockthevote.com and register. If you're in a state that does not allow online voter registration system or online voter registration, what it does is it will pre-populate a PDF form of the federal registration form, and you can print that off and mail it in. So that is what we have. And it's very exciting because then what it allows us to do is actually to follow up with individuals to make sure that they're reminded about their elections. We have a program that we run called the Election Reminders Program. So in those very important, especially in those states where you have registration deadlines and you didn't even know that you had them, which is especially important for young people, we actually will send you a text or an email to remind you that either your registration deadline's coming up or it's passing or that you're allowed to early vote. We include links to where you can go vote. We also have a whole list of, depending on where you are, what time the polls are open, what you actually need to bring with you. So all those things like the strict voter ID laws, you actually can be prepared with what you actually need when you show up to vote. So that's sort of the world that we have.
And Kristen, can you talk to us about what's next? Like, where is the fight, and what do we need to do? What's coming in, I don't know, 2 years, 5 years? Like, what's next?
We need to resist, because sadly, the reality is that voter suppression and voting discrimination remain alive and well across our country. Elections are close and hotly contested in a lot of communities, and officials and lawmakers are really bent on finding ways to make it harder for people to turn out and vote. So it's really important that people pay attention and shine a bright spotlight and speak up whenever lawmakers may be thinking about putting photo ID laws on the books. Another thing that we have to watch out for are proof of citizenship requirements. Sounds innocuous, but this is completely an unnecessary burden placed on people seeking to register and vote.
I don't even know what that is. What is that? I've never heard of that with voting.
So it's a new requirement that some lawmakers and officials like Kris Kobach are pushing.
Who is Kris Kobach?
Kris Kobach is the Secretary of State in Kansas, who was just put forth by Trump to lead this Election Integrity Commission. And he's been one of the strongest proponents of proof of citizenship requirements. Basically, when you register and vote in our country, you sign a form and you swear that all the information is accurate, your name, your age, your residence, and your citizenship status. And you attest that all of that information is true, and you sign under penalty of perjury. That system has worked for years, but now you have folks like Kobach who are saying, nope, you got to attach a copy of your birth certificate or a copy of your passport to your registration form if you want it processed. And as you can imagine, it's burdensome for many people to do that, and a deterrent for many people who seek to register and vote in our country. So these are things that people need to look out for in their communities. Purging of the voter rolls is another dirty tactic that we continue to see. This is when election officials claim, quote, we've got to clean up the registration rolls. And often what they're doing is stripping away legitimately registered voters from the rolls.
Isn't there a program that does this called, like, something check?
Yes, and that's something else that the Kansas Secretary of State has his finger.
What's it called, though? It has a name.
Yeah. Cross-check.
Cross-check. Yes, cross-check. Can somebody explain cross-check real quick? I just know about it because somebody emailed us about it during the election for us to support. And I remember being like, I've never heard of this before. Is this a real thing? What is cross-check? Tomas, were you about to explain it?
Yeah, so the upshot of cross-check is, so states...
Wait, there's an upshot? I thought cross-check was a bad thing.
No. By upshot, I mean sort of the big takeaway, not an upshot.
Okay, I was like, sort of Tomas, what are you talking about? The takeaway, go ahead.
The big takeaway of cross-check is, like, states are supposed to, you know, they have, like, a broad mandate in their statutes to, like, keep their voter rolls up to date. Now, what cross-check does is what Kobach has set up is that all these states that participate, and I think there are about 30 states that take part, send their voter rolls to Kansas, and they're supposed to compare the voter rolls in their state to the voter rolls in the other state, the idea being that they can find people who are registered to vote in multiple places. There are all kinds of problems about the way in which cross-check does this. It's actually not the only program that is trying to do this. There's another one called ERIC that's run by Pew we don't need to get into this nitty gritty, but, like, I think there are more people in the voting community are more comfortable with ERIC than they are with CrossCheck. And CrossCheck paints with this broad brush. It tends to lead to, like, these false positives and these, like, crazy numbers where, you know, I think at one point he alleged there were, like, 100,000, like, double voters or possible double voters. It leads to these very big numbers. You know, there was an investigative journalist who did some work last year on cross-check. There was, like, a big article in Rolling Stone about this right before the election. They kind of also raised some potential issues that the sampling may kind of lead to people of color appearing more on cross-check lists because of the way in which names are set up. I can't really talk too much about that. But cross-check is done in sort of too broad of a way. It's like a blunt instrument. And the fact that Kris Kobach is running it, you know, he's using it as a way to justify a lot of the stuff he's putting forward. I mean, this is a guy who, he is like the nation's foremost like plugger of the voter fraud idea. And he's also the guy who wrote SB 1070, the Arizona immigration law, HB 56, the Alabama immigration law. So this is somebody who's had his, who has made a career out of, you know, out of basically since, you know, since we're not really live right now, giving immigrants a hard time. I mean, like, this guy is affiliated with FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform. I used to work at the Southern Poverty Law Center, and like SPLC calls FAIR a hate group. I mean, this guy is bad news.
And Kristen, you were on a roll with the things that come forward, so I don't want to stop the roll because you were rolling, and I had not heard about the purge issue. I mean, I did hear about cross-check, but I couldn't remember the name, but I got that. What else, Kristen?
Well, one, we also know that voting rules vary in state by state, and so it's really important that people know the rules that apply in their state and know that there are groups like the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and the Law and the Brennan Center and others that are fighting voter suppression. So the laws may have changed. We talked about Texas's photo ID rule, but the reality is that we're winning that battle, and five courts now have found Texas's photo ID
law. Five courts?
Five times.
It took five? That's crazy.
Five times, because Texas is relentless, and they keep appealing, and they keep appealing. But five times now, courts have said this law is discriminatory, and Texas will not give up and continues to appeal every victory that we get. So just to bring it back, this illustrates why Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was so important. For the last 3.5-4 years, civil rights groups have been fighting Texas. There was a long battle in North Carolina over these voter suppression measures that likely would never have seen the light of day and never have gone into effect if we had that the heart of the Voting Rights Act in place, that Section 5 federal review process. Because when the Justice Department looked at those laws, they would have found that the laws were discriminatory and never have given those states the green light to put those laws on the books.
Got it. Now, as we come to a close, Tomas, Carolyn, I'd like to know, is there anything that we don't know about voting rights, voter ID, that we should know? Is there anything we haven't talked about that you think is like important? You know, I think I've asked a lot of the questions that I've either heard or that are like front and center to me. But is there something that like is the untold story? Like the purging, I never actually heard of pre-registration before. That like when you're 16, like that was new to me.
It's just passed in California too. So California 16 and 17-year-olds can pre-register as well.
I love it. Is there, Tomas, Carolyn, anything to add before I ask the real final question?
I would say we've been talking, and I think rightfully so, about what's been happening with these big state laws, North Carolina, Texas, Wisconsin. But there are thousands of jurisdictions that affect voting. And so the Voting Rights Act didn't just cover whole states, and it covered counties, it covered towns, it covered cities. And so when we talk about the ways in which voting can be affected, you know, it's not just these big ID requirements, it's not just things like purges, it's also where your polling place is. It's also the procedure that, you know, can be put in place in some local setting. There was recently, and this was an important development, there was recently a court decision where there was a town in Texas that was actually brought back under the preclearance requirements of the Voting Rights Act because it had, in a way that a court ruled to be discriminatory, drawn its districts in such a way to discriminate against Latino voters. And so, and this is just one locality, and, you know, it's just one small piece of a much bigger story, but there are a lot of places that are covered like this. And just like we say that voting is more than, you know, just the presidential election year, voting is also more than just the really big stories. It's your school board, it's your school board district, your water district, all these other things too.
No, I want to echo that, Tomas. Like, we, election law and policy is made at every different level and it's implemented at every different level. There are a lot of reports of men of color who are asked for voter ID, for IDs before they have to vote in jurisdictions that they're actually not required to even have IDs. That's obviously training at the local level. We forget that sometimes you can have a bill being passed that might be vetoed, a bad or a good bill that might be vetoed and only saved by the governor. So every election is really important. When it comes to voting rights, we haven't even touched on the census or gerrymandering or any of that, but so much is made at the local and the state level. And most states actually have their elections next year, aside from Virginia and New Jersey this year, that in addition, while we are sort of in this role of paying attention to the federal government and to the executive branch and to Trump's administration right now, is that we need to also be focusing on what's going on in our states and be really aware and cognizant of the laws that are going to be affecting us.
Got it. And Tomas, you said earlier that the boroughs of New York City were covered under the clearance section. That just seems so intense.
That's right. It's actually three of the five boroughs of New York City that were covered under the pre-clearance provision. It was Bronx, Brooklyn, and Manhattan. I'm from the Bronx. And I can say growing up, I never knew that that we were covered under the Voting Rights Act. And yet that's something that I think a lot of people, you know, maybe in the position that I was in as a kid may have taken for granted. You know, it's unfortunate that we don't have those protections today, whether you're talking about a place like Alabama or a place like New York City.
Okay, and we'll start with you, Kristen, as we close out. There's a question I ask everybody who comes as a guest during this section, and it is, what is a piece of advice that you've gotten that has stuck with you over your career? So we'll start with you, Kristen.
To follow your gut. I have been doing civil rights work for the last 16, 17 years because I believe that civil rights lawyers and in the courts in particular, we have the power to confront injustice and to help make our democracy better. And that's something I always encourage people to do, to follow your passion and follow your gut in thinking about the kind of choices you want to make.
And Tomas?
I would say that I would echo that. And I would also say that I got into this work for a lot of the same reasons. And I remember I had lunch with someone who was doing very different kind of work. It was a partner at a law firm, and I didn't want to go work at the law firm, I'd realized, but I decided to hear out his advice. And he said, you know, you should do whatever you think is interesting. And I think it's hard to find something that is more interesting right now than being at the center of these fights that are so important to the future of the country, that are, you know, are really where I think the action is. And I would urge folks who, you know, if you think it's interesting and the issue can be voting or it could be someone else, find a way to get involved.
And Carolyn?
I have two. I would say I was told to bring on, hire good people and get out of their way. And the second was do what is right, always.
There we go. If people want to find out more information about the work you do with regard to voting rights, where do they go? Carolyn, we'll start with you, then Tomas, then Kristen, and that will be at the end of our conversation about voting rights.
Great. So we have started voting rights newsletter. So if you come to rockthevote.com, you can sign up for the newsletter. We'll keep you up to date with everything that's moving, both at the federal and at the state level. And you can see more coming out this summer on that. And also sign up for election reminders so you never miss an election.
Tomas.
You can visit the Brennan Center website at Brennan Center, BRENNANCenter.org. And on Twitter, at Brennan Center.
And Kristen Clark for the close.
voting laws vary across the country, and so one thing we encourage people to do is to contact our 866-OUR-VOTE hotline. 866-OUR-VOTE is the number for the Lawyers Committee's Election Protection Program. It's a partnership of groups across the country that are working to confront complaints that people have when they try to register, helping people overcome the barriers that they sometimes encounter at the polls. And it's a number that we want people to use to shine a spotlight on the issues that may be unfolding in their community.
The three of you, Carolyn, Tomas, Kristen, thank you so much for making time today. And I hope that people learned from this conversation about voting rights and voter ID. So cool. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's it. Thanks for joining another episode of Pod Save the People. And three things to close. One is remember to rate Pod Save the People wherever you get your podcast, whether it's iTunes or somewhere else. The second is tell a friend, make sure that they subscribe. And the third is that remember that this work starts with you. That in so many cases, I'm reminded that we aren't born woke, but something wakes us up. And it is often a tweet, Facebook post, an Instagram post, or a podcast conversation that has invited people to see the world differently, that then pushes them to act in the world differently. I hope today's your day.